This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. White minority rule is about to end in South Africa. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear from black and white South Africans who opposed apartheid, often at the risk of their lives. Rian Malan spoke against apartheid from a unique position. His family helped create the system. His ancestors were among the original Dutch trekkers who settled in South Africa. His great-uncle, Daniel Malan, was the principal architect of apartheid and became the first Afrikaner nationalist prime minister. Rian Malan left his country in 1977 and returned in 1985 with the intention of writing a book. I spoke with him in 1990 after that book, My Traitor's Heart, was published. Malan wrote that his father had the uncanny ability to find a moral purpose in apartheid.
Well, I guess my father believed in something called separate but equal. I think he convinced himself that ethnocentricity was such a powerful force that people of various races and cultures couldn't actually get along together, and that it was in everyone's best interests that whites and blacks in South Africa be separate but equal. This was essentially a self-serving delusion, separate but equal.
Did you grow up accepting that?
You know, I don't think I ever really accepted it. I'm not sure I can tell you why, but I mean, I have this very early memory of being in our family station wagon and my father turning to me. We were in a filling station. My father turned to me and said, ask the boy to pump the back tire or something. And I leant out the window and I was going to call this grown African man a boy. And it seemed to me, it suddenly struck me for some reason that this was an impolite thing to do and that I should actually call him sir. And so thereafter, that's more or less what I did. I'm not suggesting that I was more enlightened or anything than the rest of my tribe, but maybe we're all like that in the beginning. I mean, all Afrikaans children are brought up by black people, and I think it's impossible for that sort of, if you love the people who raise you.
You say that when you were 16, you became a communist, you were also a hippie, and that it was very hip when you were a teenager for suburban white teenagers to be into black culture, but not black African culture, just black American culture. What kinds of things got through? what aspects of black American culture were you into, and why was it American and not African?
Because we lived in the sort of framework of Western culture. I tell the story in the book about playing in a blues band, which my name was Malan, and two of the guys in the band were Afrikaners too. But the music, we played Howlin' Wolf songs and Sonny Boy Williamson songs, and we considered, there we were playing the blues at segregated garage parties in John Foster's South Africa at the apogee of the apartheid era, and nobody laughed at us. We all knew the words of We Shall Overcome and so forth off by heart, but I don't think very few of us could so much as hum the tune of Nkosi Sikelel' IAfrika, which was the African national anthem. That's how it was to grow up in white South Africa.
Was this strictly a white liberal phenomenon in South Africa?
I think it's a phenomenon that was confined largely to the liberal enclaves, the sort of middle and upper middle class enclaves of the big white cities. I think a lot of us had this fantasy that it was our destiny in life to lead black people to the barricades and to freedom. But the important concept there was that we would be leaders. And I think that what we had in mind was sort of middle-class managerial positions, much like the ones that our father owned, that our fathers held, rather. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things that Steve Biko was reacting to when he founded the Black Consciousness Movement in South Africa, was this assumption on the part of white liberals that we knew what was best for blacks.
Now, you became a crime reporter.
That's correct.
And you say you studied how South Africans kill each other. You must have had something of a dual personality while covering the crime beat. I'm sure the name Malan helped you make contacts with the police. And on the other hand, when you were in the townships, I'm sure it's not a name that you offered too freely to the black people that you were writing about.
Strange that you should mention that. I used to tell people my name was John Black under certain circumstances and certain times. It seemed prudent to do so. But yes, no, I did have a split personality, and as I sit here, I think I still have one. It always seemed to me that there were always two aspects to my personality. I was an Afrikaner who despised what whites had done to blacks in my country. You know, on the other hand, I was a white who was apprehensive of Africans and was scared whenever he went into Soweto. I would not have said so then. I guess I can say so now.
Well, you were, I think, scared for a couple of reasons when you'd go into Soweto. One was that as a white person you felt like a target, and you understood why there was such hatred towards whites by mm-hmm. blacks. On the other hand, you thought that some of your fear was based in racism, based on this just kind of unnameable fear of black people that you were brought up with. How could yeah. you distinguish between the two and purge yourself of the racism while understanding when it was appropriate to be afraid?
Well, I don't know. I think that's a question that I've wrestled with my entire life and that I'll probably continue to wrestle with for the rest of my life. I mean, a lot of the fear of the whites have for Africans in South Africa is clearly phantasmagoric. I tell the story in my book of a night when I went drinking in Soweto with a friend of mine. We had several drinks too many, and we fell into conversation with some guys who were just, they were giving voice to, I guess, a pretty common sentiment in Soweto at that time in the midst of the Greist uprising. They were telling me that every white they saw was an enemy to them and so forth. And I had an acute attack of paranoia, so I decided I had to get out of there before somebody attacked me, and I went off walking through the streets of Soweto alone on foot. Now, it might sound like an ordinary thing to you to do, it struck me I felt as though I was walking on the moon, and I was quite certain that I'd never reach my car alive. I was in a state of acute terror. And my terror reached a crescendo when somebody tapped on my shoulder, and I spun around, and here was one of the guys who I was sure was plotting to murder me, tapping me on the shoulder with a big smile on his face and said, "Listen, brother, it's not safe for you to be here alone. We'll walk with you." And so there I was, revealed for what I was, a white man beset by, I suppose, what I describe in the book as racist misgivings.
Rian Milan's great-uncle was the principal architect of apartheid. Milan's memoir is called My Traitor's Heart. Emma Mashinini is a longtime opponent of apartheid and was for years a leader in the black trade union movement. She was the first general secretary of the Commercial Catering and Allied Workers Union of South Africa. In 1981, she was arrested and held without trial for 6 months. The only time she was allowed out of the cell was to be interrogated. She later worked with the families of detainees and political prisoners in her role as director of the Anglican Church's Department of Justice and Reconciliation. Her boss was Archbishop Desmond Tutu. I spoke with Mashinini in 1991 after the publication of her autobiography, Strikes Have Followed Me All My Life. She described what happened the morning the police came for her.
They came in several cars, and they were quite a number, more than 10 or so. And when they came, you know, as they would knock at the door, they knock at every window. They kick, they bang, they do everything. You open this door, they are all over. And when they got in, they just said to my family they should get out of the house. And my husband wanted to know why. And they said, "You get out, I'm being detained." And they said they were detaining me under Section 22. And they started searching and ransacking the house with everybody out of the house. I state in the book that after searching, after having done everything, when they were about to take me away, and then they called my family in. Well, there was a pile of books. I do have a lot of books. And then they wanted my husband to sign for those books as things which they were taking away. And he refused and said, "How can I sign for them? What if you brought them here to incriminate Emma?" And it was a big issue in itself. And then they took me away to my office, to my workplace, to go and search, which was where the Council of Churches was. And many people came to give me moral support. And they took me to prison. And the first time I was imprisoned in Pretoria Central Prison, and locked up with people who are on the death row.
Yeah, so you thought you would be sentenced to death,
oh,
too?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I don't know what for. Because you were just waiting. You sit there waiting and expecting to hear from them that you will be going to court or doing anything to know why you are there. And nothing happens. And then the next thing, you are just told, "Pack your bags, come." And then when you go, you think you are being released, yet you are being moved from one prison to another.
When you were arrested, you were the general secretary of a trade union, the mm-hmm. Commercial Catering and Allied Workers Union of South Africa. Mm-hmm. Did they give you any reasons for arresting you? Did you know why they had singled you out?
Never. I did not know up until the day when they left me to go home. The same way they arrested me, the same way they left me, I did not know why they arrested me and why did they release me at the same time. But it was a very horrible time, just to be left alone for 6 months in solo, solitary confinement. It was one of the horrible tortures that could happen to one.
Would you describe the cell that you were held in solitary confinement?
The first cell I was held in solitary confinement in Pretoria, I state in the book that it was so clean, small and neat because I reckon I was locked up in a section which I think was must have been reserved for whites or whatever. And the reason for that is they hide you away from even the prison warders or anybody who is working in the prison or any other person that they must never see you or see your face. I was locked up and never was to go out because the toilet and everything is there. They sealed the window and just left a very little strip for them to peep and see me from outside, and I could not see from inside, outside. I could just see the two eyes peeping at me, which was very scary. And even if they brought food, someone had to lock that. The doors were locked until someone would come and just open the door and push the food. I was moved to yet another cell, which was now very huge, big, and very dirty, with no window, windows right up there. You've never see, you don't see the sun. You don't know what is happening. And it was like it was under the rail because I could hear the trains, you know, the noise of, like, the trains where I was.
Did you completely lose track of what was day and what was night and how many days had elapsed?
Well, I had, towards the end, I definitely did lose track of that. But more than losing track of the days and so forth, the most important thing that happened to me is that because you sit there, we had no books, we had nothing at the very beginning except towards the end. Was one day I sat there thinking about my family and, you know, talking to them, you know, just in my imaginations. And I saw my baby and I wanted to talk to her and call her by name. And I discovered that I could not remember my baby's name. I had forgotten my own baby's name. And this took me days to remember who her name was. This was one of the worst tortures which happened to me by me and I torturing myself to remember my own child's name.
How did it come back to you?
I think after many days of thinking of nothing and recollecting and when the day, when it did come, I fell asleep. I slept for the day.
Oh, out of relief?
Out of relief. Out of relief of remembering my child's name.
Emma Mashinini, recorded in 1991. We'll hear from former Member of Parliament Helen Suzman after this break. This is Fresh Air. Helen Suzman has spent her life working within the South African political system to change her country's racist policies. She was a member of parliament for 36 years, from 1953 to 1989. For 13 of those years, she was the only member that opposed apartheid. I spoke with her last year after the publication of her memoir In No Uncertain Terms. She retired from Parliament in 1989. I wanted to know if she wished she could be in the new Parliament that will follow the country's first democratic election.
Well, in a way, sometimes when I read things are happening that I'd like to stand up and talk about and argue about and criticize, I am quite sorry that I'm not there. On the other hand, you know, I've had 36 years of active parliamentary work. I am now, alas, 76 years of age, and there are times when people must just get out and let younger people take over.
It's interesting because you were in parliament opposing apartheid, and now that that system is ending, and hopefully a new democracy, a new democratic era is about to begin. You won't be in Parliament to participate in it.
No, but there I am on the outside, keeping a beady eye on everything. I'm really rather pleased that I've lived long enough to see what I never expected to see.
Did you never expect to see it?
No, I honestly didn't. I thought, and I still think, you know, the government could have stayed in power for quite a long time and maintained the status quo. At a cost, of course, a cost of the economy running even further down, at the cost of escalating black resistance, which had already reached very high levels, and at the cost of more violence, all that. But you know, if you've got the army and you've got the police force on your side, you can hold the situation, as we saw with Yeltsin and Moscow not too long ago.
You were elected to Parliament just 5 years after apartheid was codified by the National Party, just 3 years after the Racial Classification Act. So this repressive system had just been put into place in an official way. What did you see as your role as the lone voice of dissent?
Well, I only became the lone voice of dissent some years after I entered Parliament, because I started as a member of the official opposition, which was the United Party, General Smuts's party, though he himself was dead by then. And we left the party when I say we, there were 11 of us backbenchers who didn't like the equivocal way in which the United Party was fighting apartheid. And we left and formed our own party in 1959. And then there was a snap election in 61 after Dr. Verwoerd had taken South Africa out of the Commonwealth and declared an independent republic. And all my colleagues lost their seats at the 61 election with the exception of myself. And that sad story repeated itself in two subsequent elections in 1966 and 1970. And then in 1974, we got back six of our original members.
So for 13 years, you were the only
Yes.
voice of dissent. Did everybody in Parliament feel like your enemy? I mean, were they unfriendly to you as well as your political opposition?
Some people were quite friendly. They sort of liked me despite my views, but most of them really were very unfriendly. I mean, I never had a meal with any of my colleagues during those years. I used to go upstairs and have a meal upstairs with my secretary and researcher, or I used to have guests in the public dining room at Parliament, but I never sat down with my caucus, with the caucus people of the National Party or the United Party.
Were you ridiculed within Parliament for being anti-apartheid or for being female or for being Jewish?
Well, a bit of all of that, but ridiculed is not quite the word. I was attacked, and that's rather different. It was much more aggressive than ridicule.
Mm-hmm.
And, being a woman didn't make any difference to me. I mean, I reckoned, I knew that if you wanted to be considered the equal of male colleagues, you had to be better than them. And let me tell you, that wasn't that difficult. And as far as being Jewish is concerned, well, you know, that depended on the way Israel behaved at United Nations, funnily enough. You know, if United Nations voted against South Africa at UN, then at least if Israel voted against South Africa resolution at UN, then I used to come in for a lot of anti-Semitic interjections. On the other hand, after Israel won the Six-Day War, I was treated as a heroine, almost as if I'd done it myself, because the government identified with Israel as a sort of small country surrounded by dark-skinned neighbors, and there was this amazing Six-Day victory.
How did you keep getting re-elected to Parliament, having a minority point of view amongst the voting white population?
Well, the sort of constituency that I represented for 36 years was what you would call a silk stocking district. In other words, professional people, educated people, upper middle class people. They never were in competition for jobs with blacks. We could never win a seat in a blue collar area or even in the rural areas, which are very reactionary in South Africa. But, I started out with just a very small majority against the United Party then, not against the Nationalists. We were accused of splitting the opposition because we'd left the United Party, and that's why all my colleagues lost their seats.
You left them because they weren't vocal enough
yes.
in their opposition to apartheid?
Well, they were very equivocal. They said that the policy was for economic integration but against social and political integration. And we were for integration. So that there was this constant row going on in the caucus with the small body of liberally minded people arguing with the majority in the caucus that we had to oppose laws which in fact were introducing social segregation and political segregation. So we had many rows, and in the end we walked out. Well, I was re-elected because, let me tell you, I was a good MP. I really was. I mean, I worked hard. I was very conscientious. I reported back to my constituents every year. I believe in accountability between constituents and Member of Parliament. I had my name in the phone books. I was available if anybody wanted either help or to complain about something I had done. And I made a lot of good speeches, which were really well reported in the English medium press. I got great coverage. Without them, I certainly could not have survived.
You know, I'm thinking about all the incredible repression that you were trying to fight, the murders of activists, the totally inhumane imprisonment of blacks, and especially of blacks who were leaders of the opposition. And yet, you had to voice your opposition in this very kind of genteel setting, the parliament. And granted, I know people were, you know, very vocal in arguing with each other, but still, it's kept with argument. I mean, this is the kind of thing people fight to the death over. You know what I mean? This is the kind of thing that people put their lives on the line for. And I'm wondering if it was ever frustrating to be dealing with such incredible repression and oppression, to be dealing with the people responsible for it, and to only be able to argue with them.
Well, I mean, short of taking a gun and shooting them, what else could one do? I mean, it was an opportunity at least to voice one's utter despair and dismay at what the government was doing, and knowing that this would probably be printed in the press the next day, and keep some values alive in that country. Otherwise, the whole thing was just a morass of, as you say, oppressive legislation and people being ill-treated without anybody even knowing about it. So it had its value. It, strangely enough, the government, for all its authoritarianism, had a very healthy respect for the parliamentary system, which was why I, who was known to be opposed to everything, was given very adequate time to debate.
Helen Suzman is a former member of the South African Parliament. Next week, she'll serve as a monitor in the elections. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.